Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other enjoyable and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
Я твой слуга, я твой работник.
Well, the next few shows are as much as anything an excuse to play some classic beats from Kraftwerk. Welcome to All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. Great to have your ears. Natasha Mitchell with you. And we're going robotic. Australia's Minister for Defence Personnel, Materiel and Science, Greg Combey, just announced a $1 million competition with the US Department of Defence to encourage the development of autonomous, intelligent robots for use in urban warfare. Well, in fact, thousands of robotic devices, you might be surprised to hear, are already being deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I will never make the claim that these systems can be perfect. There will be mistakes made still, but it is my firm belief that we can do better than human soldiers in the battlefield. What that translates into is a lessening of non-combatant casualties and collateral damage as a whole, and that saves lives, if it can be achieved. Human beings fail, and they fail in terrible ways in warfare.
Top roboticist Ronald Arkin on lethal artificial intelligences. It's an ethical battlefield on the show next week. Today we're putting robots to domestic service though, even in childcare, aged care, and perhaps beyond.
I mean, looking at my own children over the years, my children range in age from 16 now to 43, and it's the way they accept technology. You know, some of them were born just after the remote control was invented for television. And for me, the remote control was still fascinating, that I could change my television from a distance. But you watch this child lifting up the remote control, and it never knew there wasn't one.
Mm.
And similarly, my 19-year-old was born just before the World Wide Web hit. So she's had the World Wide Web all her life and thinks nothing of it, whereas I still think, wow, this is incredible. And my youngest one, of course, with Facebook and all those social networking things, they just take them for granted. So if you imagine being born into an age where robots are around all the time, you're going to have a very different conception of robot. And so maybe when you're old, it'll be fine to be with robots. I don't really know. We need to be discussing the
question. That's right. People will be so familiar personally. Their entire lives will be mediated as they grow up by digital entities. It might not be unusual for them to be looked after by a robot.
Yes, it sounds very odd to us, doesn't it?
Actually, I'm not so sure it sounds so odd to me, as unsettling as it is. Perhaps I'm more of a digital native. In fact, I was just reflecting on the first computer I was given in 83, a little second-hand Sinclair ZX81 with memory the size of a gnat. Artificial intelligence researcher Noel Sharkey there. If you're apprehensive about a robot carer showering you in a nursing home, consider this scenario at the other end of life.
Please can you play with me, Mummy?
You can't be there all the time. Robbie, peace of mind for parents and a lifelong buddy for your child. Personalised Robbie play modules to suit your most precious investment.
My Robbie.
Robbie, because you can't be there all the time.
As childcare costs have risen, even high-end professional couples have struggled to keep up. And lobbying from the vocal and well-organised child-free movement has put an end to family allowance and other government subsidies to parents. But just as the childed were beginning to feel more and more alone, technology came to the rescue. Robots never reached their potential as housework tools. Problems with fine motor skill coordination just couldn't be overcome. They could mop a floor, but only if you tidied away first. But when business refocused its robotic investment into surveillance and entertainment, they hit the jackpot. Here at Kids World, Kirk Gambino, the public face of children's Robbies, explains some of their finer points.
We have a huge range of Robbie Care systems, and what you pay for is what you get. But this is the basic starter model, and it relays audio-visual back to the parent and more or less accompanies the child responding to his or her needs.
Hi, want to play?
I think that my point of view on this is a bit old-fashioned. See, I grew up in a big family, like there were three of us, for God's sakes. And although we were struggling, yeah, we had a basic model Robbie. I remember when I first saw it, I thought it was a new kind of vacuum cleaner or something. I remember Mum said, "This is a new machine, and it's gonna sit and watch you in the bath." And I was so shocked by that thought that the first time I got into the bath with my socks on. And then that became like family folklore. We told that story every Christmas. But it actually turned out to be pretty good, that first Robbie. Not perfect like later models. It'd go off sometimes and just like spin out of control, just like rotate around at the knee joints. And funnily enough, that made it seem more human. Most of the Robbies these days are more or less indestructible.
From the brilliant prize-winning mockumentary by producer Eurydice Uroni, and I've put the full audio of that on our website. It first aired on Radio National in 2002, but Service Robotics is a serious enterprise in 2009, and it continues to provoke those eternal questions about the evolving relationship between us, flesh and blood, with silicon. So picking up again with Colin Allen, who you caught on the show a few weeks back, he's Professor of Cognitive Science and History and Philosophy of Science at Indiana University in Bloomington. His new book with Wendell Wallach is called Moral Machines, Teaching Robots Right from Wrong. Well, look, Isaac Asimov kicked us off probably when he offered his three laws of robotics in 1942, which became four laws. That was a fictional exercise, but it was a significant one, wasn't it? What was the essence of those essential laws?
Well, the original three laws say, first, don't do any harm to a human being. Second, obey a human command as long as that's not violating the first. And third, protect yourself as long as that's not violating either of the other two. So they're a strictly hierarchical set of rules. Mm. And eventually, later in his fiction, he added a zeroth law, which was supposed to have precedence over all those three, which was do no harm to humanity as a whole. But I think right from the beginning, they really were a fictional plot device. In fact, the very first story in which these appeared, a story called Runaround, there's a lot of tension between the first and the third, actually the second as well. The robot's told to go do something. It has to get something that's crucial to help humans on this remote planet get away from the planet, but it's too dangerous for itself to get this material without destroying itself. But if it destroys itself, then they're going to come to harm. So it ends up running around in circles around the source of this material. So it's very clear that Asimov used these as a way to throw up the paradoxes that you would get when you tried to boil down robotic morality to some simple set of rules.
More recently, the famous roboticist Ronald Arkin has coined the phrase bombs, bonding and bondage to describe our concerns about how we might relate to robots. What's he getting at there in terms of our anxieties?
Yeah, well, he sees three ways in which we could end up really using robots in ways that might actually not be so good for us. So bombs refers to the military applications of them. Bonding refers to the idea that robots are going to play some role in the development of the sex industry, which is actually already it's well past the horizon, it's coming. And bondage refers to the idea of robots as something like personal slaves. And let's take that last one first. The concern there is that we've had a long human history of trying to eliminate slavery, and to reintroduce it, even in the form of mechanical servants, may lead us into a frame of mind where slavery doesn't seem so bad, perhaps. So he's very worried about the potential consequences of that. So those are all focused on how having these robots around affect us. But he's also, Ron Arkin, is also working on how you make the robots, especially military robots, behave ethically in military context as well. So putting ethics, rather like Asimov was imagining, into the robots themselves.
Yes, and we'll be picking up with roboticist Ronald Arkin himself on how he's doing that on the show next week. Colin Allen, there's this intriguing concept of uncanny valley that's often talked about in AI circles, about the prospect of machines becoming more human-like. What is uncanny valley? I like this idea very much.
That's based on some research in Japan where it seems as though as you make robots more and more humanoid, more human-like in appearance, people generally tend to like that. But if you get too close to a human being, all of a sudden it drops off and these machines are just creepy and they make people have negative feelings about them. Now, the thought is that at this point, this drop-off comes from having machines that are human-like but not quite human-like enough. And if we could only get through and get even closer to human-like machines, then we'd climb out the other side of the valley and people would accept them again. So it's a hypothesis that there is a valley. So far, we've only seen a cliff as you get closer and closer to humans. But there's all kinds of theories about why this is, and the person who introduced this idea actually thinks it has something to do with reminding people of death, because what you have when you have something that's almost human but not quite human is the kind of thing that Hollywood likes to show you in a zombie movie, you know, the living dead. So it's really a rather creepy experience.
Sure is.
I don't know what to do.
And so to robots.
Okay, robot.
Hello.
Across the tabletop moves a robot scorpion. And it's suddenly wary.
I'm sorry, Dave.
You are a robot.
Robotic technologies are special in that they can interact with our human brains and bodies and social systems in completely new ways that other technologies have not done in the past. So the sense of this partnership, I think, is the difference.
MIT roboticist Cynthia Brazil speaking to The Science Show, and robotic antics there from the Remix Aficionados over at The Night Air, Friday and Sunday nights here on ABC Radio National, where you're tuned to All in the Mind with me, Natasha Mitchell, going global on Radio Australia and as podcast. Noel Sharkey is Professor of Robotics and Artificial Intelligence and Professor of Public Engagement at the University of Sheffield. And he's become vocal about the ethical and social consequences of his field. You might know him as judge on the popular TV show called Robot Wars, which pitched robots against each other.
So robots would compete two at a time against each other and knock each other to pieces, essentially.
Okay, so like your classic RoboCup, but a bit more violent.
Yes, they showed one episode in Australia, but it was too aggressive for the Australians. It's been everywhere else in the world, but for some reason it was too aggressive for Australia.
How interesting. Look, it makes for fairly unsettling reading what you've written. You've said, we are in danger of sleepwalking into a world where robots have become indispensable to service our needs, to watch our every activity, to police us, and to fight our wars for us. I mean, certainly we've always entertained, you know, the sort of dystopian scenarios about robots. So what makes this era different in your mind, Noel?
Well, because usually when it's talked about, the dystopian view is science fiction, normally. And that's the idea that robots will suddenly become super intelligent and take over the world. And what I'm talking about is not intelligent robots. In fact, it's the opposite. It's very dumb robots, which is what we've got. And it's their use by people in various roles that is unsettling me. But I have to say, before I say anything else, that I actually have a very, very positive view of robotics. Its beneficial aspects in doing dull, dirty and dangerous work and helping us in medicine and a whole plethora of things, even including therapy with autistics, which is becoming quite big. But what my role is to point out the ethical issues.
I wonder if we've been somewhat distracted by our focus to now really on whether we'll be able to develop an artificial intelligence that rivals our own, and with that prospect comes the possibility that they might come to dominate us. Has that been somewhat of a distraction?
I think it has been a distraction. Our own government here in the UK at the end of 1997 produced a document. It was the first document on ethics with robots. or rights in robots that the UK government has produced ever. And unfortunately, it was about the rights of robots, and it was a kind of fantasy document based on a few magazine articles, the idea that in 50 years' time, robots might demand housing rights and social welfare rights. Mm. And that was absolutely ridiculous. So that's the kind of distraction that we talk about. And when, for instance, the military sometimes, well, not the military, but the politicians talking about the military, kick up smoke screens about very intelligent robots, and it covers the real issues.
Я твой работник.
In normal terms, if you think about what we think of a robot working for us, it's usually one of those big robot arms working in the petrochemical industry, painting cars, building cars, that kind of thing. Now, they've been around since the 1950s. There's just over 1 million of those on the planet working. Now, service robots have been around since about the year 2000, and we've already got something like 5.5 million of those, with 18 million predicted over the next couple of years. And they're robots, they'll do things for you, like the little vacuum cleaners, you know, those little...
Roombas.
Yes, Roombas. That's right. You have window cleaning robots. We have robot surgeons that are operated by surgeons remotely at the moment, so they're not actually working on their own. We've also got things like childcare robots. There are 14 companies in Japan and South Korea building childcare robots at the moment. And we've got robots in Japan being tested in the United States and built in the United States as well for looking after the elderly. Not completely looking after them yet, but for helping them, say, it's a good thing, to helping them to the toilet, that sort of thing. Mm. Bill Gates, you know, has said that he thinks that robots will be like the internet was 10 years ago. It will suddenly be upon us and they'll be everywhere.
Well, let's go back to this prospect of Japanese and South Korean companies already developing versions of childminding robots. What do they do?
At the moment, they don't do an awful lot. I'd say they were more like mobile baby monitors, very sophisticated ones with entertainment systems on board. So, for instance, the Papiro, the cream of the crop at the moment, you can control that from your mobile phone. You can sit in another room or sit in another building or another part of the world, in fact, with a little window up on your screen, and you can see everything that the robot can see, so through its camera eyes, as it were. And you can speak to the child through your mobile phone, through the robot's voice, you know, monitor where the child is at all times. Now, the robot also has a certain amount of autonomous function, and this is where it starts to get worrying. The child can wear something called a pappy sack, which is a little infrared transmitter around its neck. And so the robot knows where the child is at all times, and it can alert you if it leaves the room, for instance. You know, most of us have put our children in front of the television occasionally when we're really busy. But with this robot, you could leave your child for longer and longer because it entertains them as well. It's got face recognition, so it can recognize their face and say, "Good morning, Mary. What game would you like to play today?" Oh. And then it can play quizzes with them. So my worry, I'm looking at the future, say 5 to 10 years. With this development, I know that parents will leave their children with them.
I mean, you have to ask what sort of attachment or what sort of relationship might a child form with their robotic supervisor over a long period of time?
Yes, this is the worry. If you leave them with them for a very short time, it's very motivating for them. Inspire them and get them into engineering or science. They'll ask questions about it. But if you start leaving with them for longer and longer periods, and there are signs of this already, actually, you'll find that the child will have to form an attachment with them. We're talking now about very young children, say pre-speech, little toddlers to about 4 years old,
child parent attachment.
Exactly, that's the target market. It's when you're learning language, it's when you're learning emotion, you're looking to your parent for motions of the face, etc. So it's quite daunting.
How are the Japanese and South Korean companies actually marketing these? What's the pitch?
Well, at the moment, they're too expensive for normal people. But there's one called Hello Kitty. Well, they've got a little robot, and it can move its arms, it can recognize your face, it can hear you, it can play some games, it can't walk. And that's being marketed as a child-minding robot. And if you look around the internet, you'll find parents, and they're terrible parents, actually, saying things like, "Now I've got the Hello Kitty robot. When I'm working long hours, I don't have to listen to the lonely cries of my child from another room." And of course, you have other people writing back, if you don't mind my language, saying, "You cold bitch, you shouldn't be a parent anyway. They'd be better with a robot." So there's some debate, but it might become normative if there's a lot of them. That's the problem.
The slippery slope.
more than just a toy. For every girl and boy, here's Dino Robbie. He's cool, he's special, and he's ready to play now. Robbie at all Kid World stores.
I mean, look, even more visceral is the current development of robots to take over some aspects of aged care. What sorts of roles are we talking about here? And I guess let's explore some of your concerns in relation to the slippery slope there.
That's quite different from the childcare. That's more of a trade-off, really, I think, an ethical trade-off, because on the one hand, I would be happy to have robots that would assist me at home to keep me out of care home for longer. If you've got dementia, for instance, it could guide you to the bathroom. It could remind you. We have these smart sensing houses at the minute that sense all around the cooker, and so it will tell you if you've left the cooker on or there's any kind of danger. So they could be a very good thing. Now, one of the bad things about them is in trying economic times, and one of the problems throughout the Western world and in Japan, particularly in Japan, is that the demographic is shifting so that the age population is getting larger and larger. Japan are moving towards a third of the population being over 65. Now, in this case, you don't have enough young people to mind the elderly.
And so the idea of having robots in nursing homes is very attractive to them, and it's a stated governmental objective, and many commercial enterprises trying to make a dollar off that too, or make a yen, I guess.
Philosopher Professor Colin Allen.
But the interesting ethical issues there is that if you start having machines that are in these contexts where they perhaps are ordering patients to take medicines, how do you write a software for a machine that knows when it should insist and when it should let the patient have their own say about whether or not to take these things? There are also other kinds of concerns which again relate back to how it changes us. So there are worries about what happens if people actually begin to find these mechanical devices more attractive than the other people around them. You know, that could be bad for social relations as well.
I mean, certainly in aged care facilities, you'll often see people hanging on to an inanimate object, a doll or a teddy bear for comfort. I wonder whether they might do the same with their robots.
There's been some mixed results on that. Some initial experiments where robotic toys were put into nursing home situation were very much in high demand, and in fact led to, because there weren't enough for everybody to have one, it led to a fair amount of discontent among the people in this particular nursing home when they had to give it up, when someone had to give it up and let somebody else use it. There was a lot of resistance to that and a lot of ill feeling. At the same time, longer term studies putting these things into elder care have suggested that at least with the technology that's being tried at the moment, the older people especially sort of lose interest in these fairly mechanical robots that have only a very limited range of abilities, and eventually prefer just a teddy bear, one nursing home director said. But I think that's also just a technological issue. I think as the composition of the aging population itself changes, because we continually have people growing up with gadgets aging, and the interactivity of the machines themselves improves, that's not always going to be the case. At some point, I think these things will be more engaging than a teddy bear.
Yeah, Gen Y might be very happy to be nursed by a bunch of robots.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's easy.
Digital natives, right to the deathbed.
Yes, exactly right. And we tend to focus on the negatives of these things, but, you know, there can also be positives too. I think that if the choice is what you see in a lot of nursing homes is a lot of people with not a lot of stimulation in their lives, an appropriately designed gadget could well actually be a good thing for them.
Old people, like all the rest of us, need love and human care and attention. And at the moment, we have this idea that we have Meals and Wheels and that sort of thing in Britain, where carers come around twice, three times a day, take you to the toilet, wash you, bring you food. And for some old people, in fact, for many of them, that is the only human contact they get. So you take that away from them, and that's one of my biggest worries, really.
There are a range of robot pets being tried in nursing homes. And I guess it could be argued, dare we consider that a robot pet may well be better than nothing in terms of company?
That's correct. It would be for a while. You're talking about Paro the seal, for instance, which is cuddly. And again, there's a trade-off
here. So this is a fur-covered robotic seal.
Yes, this looks beautiful with great big eyes that can flick open and a lovely mouth, and it makes really nice sounds. And you'll find that you'll go, oh, you know, it's one of those things that draws that out of you. And while you're cuddling it, of course, it's monitoring your heart rate and that kind of thing. So very, very useful. But the worry here is that, well, for one thing, you're deceiving people who have got dementia, who don't know any better, deceiving them into thinking it's a real companion.
And that in itself is an ethical question, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I'm not sure about it, you see, because it won't love you back the way it, and people compare them to dogs. But when you form a relationship with a dog, it's a genuine relationship. It's two-way. The dog loves you, you love your dog. With this robot, it's one way. And the other thing about it is, it's like doll therapy for the elderly. A question about, are you infantilizing them? And it loses dignity a bit, I think. I'm not sure about these questions, to be quite honest with you, and I'm raising them just because I think we need to discuss them before we start applying them.
The fanciful suggestion, but the concerning one for you, is what if robots came to be the primary carers for us as we age?
And you might as well just die as being looked after by machines. I mean, it's a horrific dystopian world, isn't it?
I'll say thanks to roboticist Professor Noel Sharkey from the University of Sheffield. Look, as a philosopher, you've got really some very tangible concerns about where we're heading and about the destructive potential of artificial intelligence, and certainly what might happen once we cross that uncanny valley. I mean, is there a risk of provoking fear here, though? Because really, have we progressed much beyond the robotic dogs and a few novelty vacuum cleaners? Why should we be concerned now? Why are you concerned now?
Yeah, well, first, I think it's because we're not actually just talking about things that are explicitly trying to be humanoid. I mean, you mentioned robotic dogs, but that's the same thing where we're trying to reproduce some living creature. But we have also robots that are not trying to be humanoid at all. For instance, robots that are being developed for use in warfare. And I would also add things that computer scientists call bots, to distinguish them from physical robots, which are automated pieces of software which operate in virtual environments, in networks, in markets. Every time you run a credit card, some computer somewhere decides whether or not to approve that purchase. These are all happening without direct human supervision. Yes, you can get on the phone and call somebody at the bank if you don't like the decision that they made, and maybe they'll correct it for you.
If you get
maybe
through.
If you get through.
Mostly you're mostly talking to a robot.
Exactly right. And there's a potential for all kinds of unthought of interaction effects. You can imagine with not too much difficulty a sort of cascade of events that could have quite dire outcome. You know, without being scaremongering about it, I think it's one way to get attention to this issue, that we are, in fact, increasingly surrounding ourselves with machines that are doing things without direct human supervision, what we call autonomous machines. And those machines are all, at the moment, what we call ethically blind. They are insensitive to what kinds of harms they might be causing by the decisions that they're taking. And a lot of that involves some very hard problems of AI, which is, first, how do you detect or anticipate harm that you might be causing? So if you go back to Asimov, you know, do no harm to a human being, how would you actually program a computer that could recognize, or a robot that could recognize, when it was causing harm? And then the second thing is, even if it's causing harm, we know that sometimes harm is necessary, even small harms. You know, the doctor sticking a needle in a child's arm for a vaccination, that's a small harm. The child's facial reaction would say, don't do this to me, but the doctor goes ahead and does it anyway because he or she judges that this is something that is worth the little bit of harm for the potential benefits. So could you program that kind of decision-making or any other kind of moral decision-making into a machine?
I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Could you indeed? And that's what I'm picking up on next week. The prospects for a moral robot in war, autonomous military machines that can kill but have ethics. How could that be? Philosopher and cognitive scientist Professor Colin Allen there from Indiana University. The podcastable audio, transcripts and references all on the website. I'd really love your comments on this one on the All in the Mind blog too. Head to that via abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. And thanks to the definitely not artificially intelligent colleague Anita Barrow and to Kerry Dell. I'm Natasha Mitchell.
There are 200,000 doctors in the UK. There are millions of doctors in the world. There are tens of millions of people with PhDs. I would put it to you that there is no imaginable assertion so absurd that you couldn't find at least one doctor somewhere in the world who was willing to defend it to the death. That doesn't mean anything about whether it's a real phenomenon.
Dr. Ben Goldacre knocking the concept of internet addiction. And you can also hear the novelist Ian McEwan. From the Radio National website, you can download or stream this science show, still hooked on the net.